So it's a real pleasure to be here to give this talk. This is the last review talk or not a conference summary talk. So it's going to be fairly prospective about what we hope to do in the future. So I hope it leaves everybody with a warm and fuzzy feeling. I will say that I've learned a lot at this conference, which makes me really excited. I'm very excited about all the things we can learn. But I've also learned to be worried about surface effects. So it's not all good. OK, so a brief outline of my talk. First of all, I'm going to try and tell you in clear language that the rest of astronomy is getting excited about what astroseismology can tell us. So I want to highlight a couple of things, most particularly what's already been mentioned, the fact that ages are of immense interest to a great many people outside of the stellar community. But I'm also going to speculate a little bit about some other things we can hope to learn on the big, medium, and small scale, so from the universe to the atom. But that's not it. The galaxy just doesn't take. The galaxy also gives. And in particular, it gives us a variety of different kinds of stars. And I'm going to focus specifically in this talk about the stellar populations in the Kepler field. The more data, the better in this particular case. And so I want to introduce the Apogee Survey, which is an H-band high-resolution spectrograph that gets 300 stars at a time. With this, we can get stellar parameters and ages, abundances based on stellar spectra. And we're going after the astroseismic targets in the Kepler field. And we're hoping to set up a very productive collaboration between the oscillations and the stellar spectra community. And then I also want to end with a couple of thoughts of the, illustrating the fact that not all stellar populations are represented in the Kepler field and the Corot fields, and thoughts about that. All right, so as been stated earlier, ages are really important. In order to understand the formation and the evolution history of an object, kind of need to know its age, know the ages of its constituent parts. So the classical way of doing this is to do something like was done in this Fermi paper. You have the effect of temperature on this axis. You have the volumetric magnitude on this axis. You could also have the log g. You measure these two things in your star. And if it's near the main sequence turnoff, you can do something like this, where you've plotted isochrones of the correct metallicity and the correct alpha to iron abundance. This is the alpha element, things like oxygen, calcium, those kinds of things. And then with these different ages here, you can read off the age of your particular star. Fabulous, right? We can actually get some ages for nearby stars. So the problems with this are that you need to get this value over here. This value's got issues. It's got color temperature relations or systematics tied up in here. But I'm going to focus on this one right now. So you either need to know the distance and the reddening quite accurately. You need to get, or you can do it with gravity, but that is tough to measure at the factor of two level. Then, even if you can make the observational measurements really well, you're still tied to stellar models. And they involve nasty things like radii. And that's always a concern. So you'd like to be a little bit more immune from the systematics. And as I said before, this is only for things near the main sequence turnoff. So Gaia is going to help. It's going to help in this axis a lot, getting some distances for us. But it's not going to help with the systematics, and it's not going to help with the reddening. So it will not answer all of our prayers. So here's the kind of interesting things that you can do. This is from a recent paper on the Geneva-Copenhagen survey for stars near the solar neighborhood. Here's the age in billions of years on this axis. Here's the metallicity in FeH on that axis. These black points here mark the mean FeH as a function of age. If you go along here, these represent the scatter up there. And you can see that there's not a real strong age-metallicity relationship in the solar neighborhood. And this is somewhat surprising if you have a really naive view of how chemical evolution works. The oldest star should be the most metal poor. The youngest star should be the most metal rich. So something more interesting is going on here. And one of the ideas that's really gained force in the past couple of years is the idea of radial mixing. That is, the old stars at high metallicity came from the inner parts of the galaxy, which formed first. These ones came here, came from the outer part of the galaxy. And they've all come together into the solar neighborhood. Maybe that's correct. But in order for it to be correct, the inner parts of the galaxy have got to be older than the outer parts of the galaxy. Is this true? We don't know, because we're so confined to the solar neighborhood. So this is a similar plot to what Andrea showed. Here is the X position in the galaxy, Y position. The galactic center is right here. This is the sun. This blue circle is my attempt to give you an idea about how far out we can measure ages currently with the isochrone method. So that's Geneva-Copenhagen, kind of 300 parsecs. This is my very crude attempt to get some distances for Corot, looking towards the more towards the center, more towards the anti-center, and over here for Kepler. And you can just see from there the difference it's going to make in our view of the galaxy, that we are no longer tied to stars here, which are mostly stars that are going around the sun with us, a few visitors from other parts of the galaxy, but really, really confined to our neighborhood. So this is going to be really great. So that was my main emphasis on age. So age is a clear winner. I want to go through a couple of other ideas. I'm going to say up front, I realize that a bunch of these are probably optimistic. I realize a bunch of them are not going to work. But we've been stymied in various aspects of how to move forward in stellar structure, stellar atmospheres questions. And so I was trying to think big, trying to think really exciting things. All of this is what you're saying is, listen to what I have to say, but don't rain on my parade, at least until after the reception. Okay, so let's dream big first. So one of the things we would like to do is we'd like to know the ages of stars in the halo. We can do this from a variety of methods. This is a new one. And so if you want to write your Nature paper, you would write it up as a test of lambda CDM. We want to know the age difference between the thick and the thin disk. We are now at the stage where N-body and SPH models can now model the Milky Way, or at least things that kind of look like the Milky Way. And so they can make predictions about what the stellar populations are going to look like throughout the history of the galaxy and across the galaxy. We want to be able to compare with those models. We can measure the star formation history of the Milky Way. We can actually put the Milky Way on the Madow plot. One thing I want to highlight is the time scales for chemical evolution. So this is a famous plot in galactic chemical evolution. This particular one was taken from this work. Here's Fe on H on this axis. This axis represents various alpha to Fe ratios. So we have oxygen to iron, magnesium to iron, silicon to iron, calcium to iron, titanium to iron. And you'll notice that they start off elevated above the solar. The solar value is indicated by the dashed line. And then they turn over and start heading back down towards the solar value. And the standard lore, going back to Tinsley and Oehmler, is that this represents the yields of type 2 core collapse supernovae. They make lots of alpha elements. They also make some iron. This knee happens when the type 1As start contributing large amounts of iron and not much or any of the alpha elements. So this is generally thought to happen about a billion years after the onset of star formation in the system. And it's been used as a clock throughout galactic and extragalactic studies. So people who argue that elliptical galaxies formed quickly are oftentimes relying on the high alpha to Fe ratios that they measure from things like the Lick indices. You try and figure out where that 1 giga-year came from. You start, you know, going through old journals, following references back, digging through cobwebs. Basically, it relies on a calculation of Francesca Matteucci and the Trieste group, which suggests that if their model is correct, that type 1As come from double degenerates, starting with 8 solar masses, stars that have main sequence masses of 8 solar masses, are the progenitors of the first type 1A supernova, that they start contributing after 30 million years, and they start contributing significantly. You can kind of notice it in the chemical abundances after about a giga-year. But that's what it's based on. It's not based on actual dating, let's put it that way. So it's a very intriguing thing. We all talk about it, 1 giga-year, 1 giga-year, 1 giga-year. It'd be nice to know if it were actually true. And we can hopefully get enough stars on this end and on this end right here to tell the difference. And actually see whether or not 8 solar mass plus 8 solar mass stars becoming double degenerates, becoming type 1A supernova, is the way to go. And you know what happens? If you can get progenitors of type 1A supernova and you can start measuring the properties of type 1A supernova, Nobel Prizes. All right. So a couple of more moderate things. We can hope to get the best rending map of the Kepler field. Ideally, we could get mixing along the red giant branch and the asymptotic giant branch as a function of metallicity. If we know masses of AGB stars, either core masses or present-day masses, get some constraints on what kind of AGB stars make lithium. Because right now, if you look at the Caracas yields, she says they're there. If you look at the Ventura and Daytona yields, they think it's over there. That's kind of a big difference. I'd really like to know where it's going. Thanks. All right. So in the interest of time, I'm going to skip over this, but I do want to write a paper where we measure the CN dissociation potential using abundances in astroseismology. So observations of the Kepler field have been very extensive. We have GRIZ, we have TUMAS, we have light curves, all available in the Kepler input catalog. We have UGRIZ, which is the native Sloan system as well. WISE, which is an infrared satellite, is going to release, or maybe already has released, some near IR and mid IR data. And the field is slightly off the galactic plane, so this is great. So I went and I grabbed some colors from the KIC. This is G minus R versus G. So the black points are just a sample of stars from the KIC. The red stars are the red giants that have been targeted for long cadence data. So you can see they do a pretty good job of getting a bunch of different stars of different magnitude and different color over there. And this means they comprise a wide variety of populations in the Kepler field. If we could stick them all at one distance, like we can for M5, the globular cluster, here's color versus magnitude, you see that we're going to have RGB, horizontal branch, and red clump, and AGB stars all hanging out together in the Kepler field. And one of the interesting things is the ratio of this to this and this to this depends on things like helium and age. And it's unfortunately difficult to determine AGB status based on photometry or spectroscopy, especially for the early AGB. For the things that are above the red giant branch tip, I think we can do better. So we'll hopefully wait for Gaia for those. But it'd be lovely to have the same diagnostic for the AGB as we have for the red clump, though I understand it's not as likely to be successful, but we can dream. So something else is the Metallicy distribution function. This is a galactic model from the Bezosol model. Here's Fion H, here's the fraction of stars in the Kepler field. They're supposed to have different metallicity. You notice that most of them end up around minus 0.5, minus 0.3 is expected for this population. But about 100 out of 10,000 stars should have Fion H below minus 1.5. which I think will be really interesting for both stellar structure and for galactic studies populations. And one of the ways we hope to do better is by getting Washington photometry with Paul Harding, which is sensitive to metallicity. Right now we have preliminary spectra for 13 Kepler giants with metallicity, we hope. Courtney Epstein is currently analyzing those data. And ideally we could use this to identify additional GO targets. So this is a spectrum not of a metal core star, but of an optical spectrum of a star that we just got. Wavelength versus intensity. And I know some people can only deal with frequency on the cross axis, so there it is in terahertz. Okay, apogee is really cool. And since I'm running out of time, I will just say H-band spectra, signal to noise of 100. We can do a bunch of things with it. And we started preliminary observations in May, commissioning observations in May, survey operations in September. This is from May. People are happy. If you know John Holtzman, that's his happy face. One of the really cool things we can hope to do with apogee, in addition to effective temperature and log G, is to go beyond this. Right? So that's the astronomer's periodic table. This is the apogee periodic table. Different colors represent the likelihood we're going to get different things. Yellow is always going to get, we hope. And those will get things like carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen, which can be major contributors to opacity in stars, as well as things like iron and nickel, but even manganese, and on maybe for the most enhanced stars, cerium and rubidium. Okay. So the current plan is to get apogee spectra of targets. We're hoping to get as many as we can of the red giants, both the public targets and the CASC targets. Hundreds right now. We have the list from about 500 from Bill Chaplin of the stars with astroseismology in the subgiants and dwarfs, and we're putting them on plates. We're hoping to do this get together with, because Sloan, Apogee is part of Sloan. Sloan has its set of rules. TASC has its set of rules. We're hoping to meld these into some kind of harmonious thing, though, since I just told you about, you know, how this could impact Lambda CDM, we're all going to turn into horrible, nasty, biting cosmologists, but okay. So right now, we're discussing this. We're calling it the ACK. If we come up with a better acronym, that's great, because right now I'm thinking this is our math. And so right now we have about 1,000 Kepler targets so far, and we'll hopefully finish up a few more hundred before the field sets. And just an idea of the excitement in the other parts of galactic structure, for example. Originally, Courtney Epstein, Mark Pinsano, and I had proposed for a few hundred targets in Kepler and Corot fields. And then people figured out what we could learn from this, and they're like, why aren't we getting thousands? And I'm like, but, and I was thinking of all the reasons why we shouldn't get thousands, and I'm thinking, why am I doing this? Let's get thousands. So we hope to get improved ages and atmospheric parameters. Hopefully this will feed back into the seismic community in the form of improved scaling relations. We can do things like tell you whether or not the carbon or the alpha elements are the same for the star with the same Fe on H. So again, depending on how subtle we want to go, maybe we can do some pretty cool things there. And look for messages from your CAS working group head, because we're thinking that's how it's going to get organized. Last point, it's a big galaxy out there. Kepler's looking here. Kepler's not getting all the interesting things. I just want to, this is the diagnostic proof of this fact up here. Let me just say, people out there are claiming high helium for some globular cluster stars. And they're claiming that these stars over here have very different helium than these stars over here. It's a strange idea. It's bizarre. We don't know how to explain it, but every other idea doesn't work. So we're kind of left with this. Also, really interesting recent paper from Nataf et al. Suggesting that there's a high helium in the bulge. And neither globular clusters nor the bulge stars are present in Kepler and Corot fields. So I have a suggestion. So I know it costs money to point Kepler somewhere else, like millions of dollars. But here we are. Here's Ames. This is Google Maps walking path, because I think we should all organize ourselves and head up to Ames. Okay. Maybe more realistically is we can start focusing on other ways to do it. Ground-based observations. As Tim has said, Ogle's already done it. There's a paper out there. LSST, I know budget situation's crazy. LSST, I think, is coming eventually. And they're looking for ideas about what kind of cadences they should do to get some interesting data for various communities out there. We're thinking about organizing a group to try and ask LSST to do some interesting things for astroseismology. So if you're interested, let me know. So we hope to get a little piece of that pie as well. Weak limbs, Earth shouldn't get all of it. And obviously space missions, and hopefully the Kepler extension will go through even if they don't point it somewhere else. So let me just leave my conclusions up there. So again, many other fields of astronomy are interested in what you guys have to say, and the galaxy gives in return. So revolution in many areas of astronomy. Thanks.
Thank you very much. On space, we, of course, maybe have the TESS mission, which is good, and we should still fight for the PLASO mission, even though it has some problems at the moment.
Right.
Because both are probably going to cover a wider range of stars.
Yep.
So?
I just have a quick question. Can you say more about these very helium-rich stars in the globular cluster? I mean, what specifically is not fitting the models with normal helium content?
So the problem is, thanks. Good question. The problem is that when you look at the O to Fe, so amount of oxygen and amount of sodium in globular cluster stars, you find some that have exactly what we see in the field, very normal for chemical evolution. No problem explaining that. These up here with O to Fe of -1, so 1/10 the solar ratio of oxygen to iron, and you know 7 times the sodium to iron ratio we see in the sun, can be explained if these things were very heavily polluted by intermediate mass AGB stars at the end of their lives. And you can't do that without giving them a ton of helium. So in order to get this low in oxygen, this high in sodium, nucleosynthesis says it has to come with helium. And that's how they're they're claiming that it has to be helium. They've tried to look at other diagnoses, whether or not it matches the color magnitude diagram and their indications in the colors of stars, how hot they are, how hot the surface temperatures are, but this is not completely crazy. But it's really fine-tuned. Like you take the enrichment from these particular kind of stars, but not these other kinds of stars. And so it's just really weird. But they've tried other ideas, and those don't work. So
this is a stellar population question. The ultra-faint satellites that have been found, mm-hmm. from Sloan mostly, you know, they have Fe on H of minus 2 or less. So my question is, in the nearby sample that you showed from Holmberg et al., are there any examples of stars of that low metallicity in the solar neighborhood? Or so in the disk at all?
So Rafe has found things below minus 2. I don't know if below minus 3, below minus 2 that appear to be a part of the disk going around with this kinematics. Depends how close you define solar neighborhoods. So there's a 6-magnitude star that has an Fe on H of minus 2.5. So certainly there are things coming through the solar neighborhood.
Right.
From the halo, which right. are quite low metallicity.
If you made a galactic distribution of low metallicity objects, mm-hmm. less than minus 2, do you think, is there actually evidence that most of those are still out in the ultra-faint satellites, that there's not a bulge population or anything at that low metallicity?
No. Most of them, I mean, the number of stars in the ultra-faints is far outweighed by the number of stars in the galactic halo.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of signs that there are that the halo concentration increases towards the center, just like you expect.
Got it.
Yeah.
Any further questions, comments? Galaxy is too large, clearly, to handle for stellar people like us. So thank you very much again.
Thanks.
And the final talk is by Douglas Goff. And I think he should have the final word, although, I mean, I don't know what the rules are at KICP. So I was planning to give him 30 minutes, but if you want to have a discussion with him, well, you can have a glass of wine at the reception, so let's do it that way.